Hello! Welcome to Sleep Money, your guide to the business and finance news of a week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios. I'm here with Elizabeth Spires of New York Times.
Hello.
I'm here with Emily Peck of Axios.
Hello, hello.
Sam Bankman-Fried was sentenced to 25 years in jail. We are going to talk about that. We are going to talk about the credit card settlement, which might wind up causing people to get charged different prices depending on what type of Visa or MasterCard they have. To start off, though, we are going to talk about the latest meme stock on the market, Trump Media and Technology Group, trading under the ticker symbol DJT. It's memeing up the stock charts. We have a Slate Plus segment all about cocoa and the price thereof. It's all coming up on Slate Money. Okay, should we talk about how former President Donald Trump has become a meme stock?
We should.
You don't seem excited about this, Emily.
I mean, it's like we try very hard here on Slate Money and have tried really hard, I think, for the past 8 years, longer, to avoid talking about Donald Trump. He comes up, but now he's intersected with the market and with business and finance news in such a way that we must discuss DWAC or DWAC, or however you want to say the name for the Trump SPAC, WAC, SPAC.
Trump's back. So Trump, when he got kicked off Twitter, started his own social network, as you do. He called it Truth Social, and it struggled to raise money, and it struggled to raise revenues. And in fact, according to its financials, it contrived to lose $49 million in the first three quarters of 2023 on $3.3 million of revenues. So on its face, not a great business. It has about 5 million unique users, which is a rounding error by the standards of most social networks. It is, as far as I can tell, almost entirely American. It exists no other country. And normally this would be a vanity play. You know, if some celebrity launches their own social network, a few of their fans like will download it and then they'll forget about it and they'll move on. But we are now in the era of meme stocks. And I think this is the thing that interests me the most, is that I was uncertain whether meme stocks would survive the end of the ZIRP era, whether now that interest rates are high, whether that was going to like kill meme stocks. But now we're seeing not only this become a meme stock, we're also seeing arguably possibly Reddit become a meme stock. And most notably, we're seeing the resurgence of a bunch of like meme coins as well, like dog with hat and bonk and things like that. So the memes are back, people. And DJT, which is the ticker symbol of the now public Trump Media and Technology Group, is trading on the markets at crazy capitalizations. It has, because Trump himself owns about 60% of the stock, it has made him a clear multi-billionaire. Like all of these debates that people used to have about like, does he really have all of that money? Well, now he does, right? Now he owns
sort of
like $5 billion worth of stock in Trump Media. And like, if you look at any billionaire, like mostly their billions are held in stock of public listed companies. That's a legitimate form of wealth. And he has a lot of wealth now.
That's true. But I think we have to sort of articulate what that means. And part of it is, you know, he owns around 60% of the company. That's around $6 billion on paper. But he's locked up for 6 months. And if he sells it in any massive volume, then ostensibly the stock goes down. Other shareholders are mad. I mean, whenever you have a big sell-off, that's usually bad news for the other shareholders and the value of the stock goes down. Right now, around 11% of the stock is held by short sellers, and that's versus, you know, 5% in a normal company.
And that's astonishing. It's almost impossible to short this stock right now. I was having dinner last night with an investor who told me that the cost of a borrow, if you want to borrow Truth Social stock so that you can sell it in the market and sell it short, the cost of that is 250% per year.
Yeah, that's also because SPACs are really hard to short. You know, mutual funds and ETFs are not generally going to hold them. So that's part of the premium.
Well, it's not a SPAC anymore. Yeah, now it's a real listed company. And this is why we're talking about it now. To be clear, there has been this SPAC stock called DWAC or DWAC or something, Digital World Acquisition Corp, that has been trading since September 2021. And for most of that time, it has had a stated intention to acquire Trump Media and Technology Group. And so there was a lot of kind of jostling for position in DWAC stock, sort of in anticipation of this event happening and in anticipation of Truth Social being a public company. But it's only this week that Truth Social has actually been a public company.
This is such a strange SPAC because for a lot of the investors, it's really just kind of like a call option on MAGA. And you can't really say that about the other meme stocks. You know, there are dynamics here that just don't exist in any other SPAC or meme stock.
There are other ways Trump could cash in on his stock without selling a big chunk of it and risking the stock price going down. He could borrow against the stock, right?
Like borrowing against the stock also, like you're borrowing from a bank normally, and then the bank wants to hedge the risk that the stock will fall. So they will basically short the stock. So that involves them effectively selling the stock. It still produces downward pressure on the stock. But honestly, like if his stock is worth $6 billion and, you know, he needs to raise, you know, $300 or $400 million or something, then like he's not selling a huge amount. And look, there was 55 million shares traded on the first day that it was, you know, officially a company. There's a lot of volume in this stock. There's a lot of people playing it for the lulls and for the memes and for the, you know, volatility. I'm not nearly as convinced as Elizabeth that, like, if Trump wanted to spend a few weeks selling down his stake, that he couldn't find buyers for it, especially if he's president at that point and, you know, the Saudi wealth fund wants to make friends with Trump. So they're like, yeah, we'll just, you know, come in and buy your stock. That's completely legal.
I think the bottom line is, if you want to call it a meme stock or not, there's value in a stock that is associated with Donald Trump right now. As much as I hate to say it, his brand is quite valuable. There are people who want to buy shares to support him.
It's considered to be a way of showing your support for Donald Trump. And there are always going to be a lot of people who want to do that.
And if he becomes president, then the value of the company and the stock shoots up to who knows where, because then suddenly this guy is the most, you know, he's the president of the United States. You can show support for him by buying the stock. You can follow him and the things he says. You'll have to theoretically be on Truth Social. So that would theoretically drive a lot of traffic. Like the platform all of a sudden becomes incredibly relevant if he actually wins the election. So like betting on the stock almost makes sense. Now it's terrifying to think of someone that powerful owning a social network. We already see what it's like when a billionaire who is what, unpredictable, capricious, racist, narcissistic, owns a social network. We are living through that now, and it's not pretty. Like we saw what happened on X with the Baltimore Bridge collapse, and you know, we saw the conspiracy theories running rampant and all of this. It's really scary, but like bottom line is I think it's more valuable than just like some random coin someone made up.
It's also valuable because there are a lot of people who assume that Trump, if he is president, will use the site as kind of like a backdoor mechanism for light bribery or emoluments. In the same way that his hotels became magnets for foreign dignitaries who wanted to suck up to him.
This is much easier, right? It's much easier to just buy a bunch of stock on the open market and then go along to Trump and say, hey, guess what? I'm a major shareholder in your company. Than it is to sort of quietly, you know, run up a bill at the Trump Hotel and hope that the news gets back to Trump that you got him money that way. And
I mean, that's so bananas that someone can be president and you can buy shares in their company. Like didn't they make Jimmy Carter like get rid of his peanut
Form. Well, the thing is, these are norms. They're not really laws technically. So Jimmy Carter got rid of his peanut farm because it was what he was supposed to do. It's what we expect presidents to do.
Yeah, there was this thing called the emoluments clause, but like we discovered in Trump's first term that that's basically unenforceable and it has no teeth. And so, yeah, there's a very good chance that all of this would be illegal. And there will be all manner of wailing and gnashing of teeth and rending of garments by various ethicists. But it's clearly going to happen. And I think there is a certain amount of wishful thinking going on among people saying, oh, it's just paper wealth. And oh, he's locked up for 6 months. And oh, it's not real liquidity. And he's not really as rich as everyone's making him out to be. And I'm like, yeah, no, actually, like that, you know, for one thing, the lockup is nothing, right? If he wanted to go to his board and ask them to waive the lockup, if it becomes like September, October, and he's run out of money in his election campaign and he wants like an extra $1 billion to get elected, and he says, the easiest way I can raise this $1 billion is to just sell $1 billion of DJT stock, that is going to help me get elected. And hey, board, which includes my sons and my most MAGA supporters, do you think you could waive the lockup so that I can do that? They would have it waived before he could even end the sentence.
So what happens in November if he loses the election? Then I assume DJT goes, whatever the slide whistle equivalent is. Something.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that it's a bet on Trump and a bet on Trump's cultural relevance. And clearly he's going to be culturally relevant through November. After November, if he loses, I mean, obviously he's not going to concede. He's still going to be out there being Trump. But if he loses, I think there will be more people like kind of like, why am I still holding on to this? And there will be less incentive for, you know, foreign wealth funds to be supporting the stock.
Wait, so Truth Social has 5 million monthly active users. Pinterest has 250 million monthly active users by comparison. I don't even think of Pinterest when someone says, name a big social media company.
But the point, like one of the things that I wrote about this week was, if you think about Truth Social as a meme investment and look at its valuation in comparison to, you know, the valuation of Dogecoin or the valuation of GameStop at its peak, or the valuation of like Robinhood at its peak, or Upstart at its peak, when, you know, when they were like full of vim and meme vigor, like it's actually not that big. There's a lot of meme coin. I think Dog with Hat is worth more than Trump Truth Social. So like what I'm saying here is that objectively the valuation is insane. It's completely unsupportable on any kind of fundamentals. That's how memes work. But by the same token, yeah, it can go up. 100% it can go up.
I want to talk about the meme stock resurgence, but also about your definition of what a meme stock is, because you mentioned Dog with Hat several times, but also Robinhood. And to me, Robinhood is beyond meme stock. Like, this is a company with value, with a product that people use that it makes money from. So how is it a meme stock?
So it's not anymore. For like a hot minute after it went public, it was. And then it isn't anymore. A stock becomes a meme stock when it stops trading on any kind of hopes or valuations for the company and starts trading just as a speculative ticker symbol.
Don't a lot of stocks trade on speculation beyond like things that are classically thought of as meme stocks?
I think there's probably a gray area between just, you know, garden variety speculation and GameStop.
You could probably make the case for Tesla, at certain periods of Tesla's existence.
Yeah.
But no, like the overwhelming majority of stocks, people are like, I want to invest in this company because I think the company is going to be better in the future than it is in the present.
Why they're investing in DJT. They think they want to invest in this guy because he's going to be president at some point.
And to remember and to be clear, like, we do not live in a world where you can buy stock in individuals. They are not investing in Donald J. Trump. They are investing in DJT, which is
right,
a
and
meme.
They're not investing in Elon Musk, they're investing in Tesla, but it's like, come on,
exactly.
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bet.
The valuation is completely decoupled from the underlying business.
Yeah, the underlying business, you know, probably if he becomes president, will make more than, you know, $1 million a quarter because people will start buying ads in an attempt to to bribe Trump. But even then, it will be very hard for the business to even make a profit, let alone grow to any kind of, you know, multi-billion dollar valuation. This is a off-the-shelf, open-source Mastodon clone, and not a very well-executed version of that. The company, Quay Company, has maybe some growth potential, but nothing to justify this kind of valuation. And so when I was talking about how, like, Robinhood was a meme stock, I was talking about when it was worth $60 billion, right? When it was worth $60 billion, that wasn't because people were like, well, if you run a discounted cash flow analysis on the possible future, you know, profits, and you plug in various assumptions, then it comes to 60. No, they were just buying the stonk because it was going up. And they were like, number go up.
I mean, I guess that's just part of, like you were saying at the beginning, meme stocks didn't go away after zero interest rates, after ZIRP went away. Meme stocks are just investing like that, as divorced from the fundamentals, based on the vibes and, you know, believing in something or someone. That's exactly. Just part of it now. That's just part of the reality now.
Yeah.
So what's the bottom line here? Truth Social is a public company. People can invest in the president of the United States maybe at some point, and that's really messed up.
Yeah, it's not like there's a business under there. If you've ever been on Truth Social, it's horribly shitty. And you know, you said something about you thought all the users were in the US. They're actually not. They have around 5 million monthly active users, and that's a very small number if you know anything about website reach and social reach in particular, but only 1 million of those are in the US. I'm not sure what the breakdown is.
Wait, where are the rest? They're in like Kazakhstan?
I guess.
That's weird.
They're probably bots, honestly.
They're probably just foreign bots. But like, why can't we have like good Made in America bots? God damn it. That's what I want to know.
The mainstream media is doing everything within their power to foment hatred and anarchy. They are fake news and truly bad people with a sick agenda.
Before we go to the break, I'm going to tell you about our Slate Plus today. This week, we are talking about, because tomorrow is Easter, but also because I love to talk about it, we are talking about chocolate. We're talking about the recent spike in cocoa prices and also how long it would take me to eat 250 Kit Kats. Anyway, if you're not a Slate Plus member and you don't want to hear ads and you do want to hear us talk about chocolate and you want a bunch of other great Slate stuff, you should sign up for Slate Plus. With Slate Plus, you get ad-free listening on all the podcasts from Slate. Plus, you get unlimited access to Slate.com content. There's a newsletter that's really good. And yeah, every week, an exclusive bonus segment where we really just go wild. We really open up in the Slate Plus segment. So sign up at Slate.com/plus. That's Slate.com/plus.
So now that we have all sold out of our S&P 500 index funds and gone all in on Trump Media and Technology Group, let's move on and do the former king of the memes himself, Sam Bankman-Fried. He had his own coins. He had coins which were worth much more than $6 billion. He had, like, there were a whole series of what were called Sam coins, including a coin called FTT that he would just issue in almost unlimited quantities, assign some random value to, multiply by the unlimited quantities that he was issuing, and call himself a trillionaire. Smart. And there were various other ones as well, including Solana and others, which some of which have bounced back. Solana's doing quite well right now. Anyway, it turns out that a huge chunk of what he was doing was incredibly illegal. There was a very high-profile court case in Lower Manhattan. He was convicted of many crimes, and this week he was sentenced and the judge gave him 25 years. And that is a lot of years. And there were two main reasons why he got such a long sentence. The first was just the sheer enormity of the crime. And I'm using that word advisedly. This is not the wrong sense of the word enormity. This is the true sense of the word enormity. But part of the judge's sentencing was not just that he goes to jail for 25 years, but also that he repay $11 billion in damages. So yeah, $11 billion, that's a big crime. That's a lot of damages. And that was one reason why he got such a long sentence. The other reason was that the judge said that he had never seen such a sort of shiftiness, such perjury, such lack of remorse from a defendant. You know, that Sam Bankman-Fried kept on saying, even in his, you know, the brief he gave to the judge saying, please be gentle on me. You know, he kept on saying, I kind of didn't do anything wrong. It's like, yeah, actually you did. You know, he's like, there weren't any victims. It's like, actually there were.
He also rubbed the judge the wrong way in a lot of ways. He lied on the stand. He had his bail revoked because he was accused of trying to intimidate witnesses. Yeah. He seemed even more evasive than most people in this situation would be. And so the judge said that he also thought that SBF had such an insane tolerance for crazy risk that, you know, if he had a shorter sentence, he's just going to turn around and do something incredibly risky again. And sort of portrayed him as, the prosecutors referred to him as a pernicious, as someone who had a pernicious megalomania. And so SBF's response to that, or his defense's response to that, was that he was sort of unlikable on the stand because he's autistic, which I'm not sure that's, I've never read that anywhere.
I think he has had a diagnosis, and he does remind me in many ways of Martin Shkreli. And like Martin Shkreli, he made the case at his criminal trial that the sentence should be light because it was like a victimless crime and people didn't lose money. Now, in Martin Shkreli's case, this was actually kind of sort of true. But, you know, the judge addresses this. He's like, if you steal $1 million and take it to Vegas and win lots of money and then hand $1 million back, like, you've still stolen $1 million and you still go to jail. But at least in Martin Shkreli's case, you know, he had a bunch of like risk-taking equity investors who did get paid back in full. There were very few obvious victims of his crime. In the case of FTX, John Ray, who's now running FTX, is, you know, says that the total claims on FTX are $18 quadrillion, $18 billion. No one knows exactly who is owed what. But just to give one example, if you look at the customer accounts at FTX when it failed, customers thought that they had 100,000 bitcoins on the exchange. In fact, the number of bitcoins that was held by FTX on the exchange was 105. Basically, SBF had sold 100,000 bitcoins that didn't belong to him, and, you know, in an attempt to keep the exchange afloat. And at $60,000, you know, those 100,000 bitcoins are worth $6 billion right there. This is just mind-boggling amounts of money that were being stolen.
Just to contextualize, you know, the prosecutors asked for 40 to 50 years, and SBF's lawyers asked for 6.5. And just to put this in relative context, the max he could have gotten was 110. Bernie Madoff got 150, and Elizabeth Holmes got 11. So do we think 25 seems like the right number?
He's getting more than twice what Elizabeth Holmes, you know, got for what she did at Theranos. And I agree with Felix that there are victims for SBF's crimes. I mean, he was basically stealing customers' money from the beginning. There's a good Bloomberg piece on this. But there was, FTX from the beginning was just a vehicle for, so that seems bad. But like Elizabeth Holmes, you know, she messed with people's health and misled them about real health concerns. And that's a real public health danger to a different kind of level than Sam Bankman-Fried's crime. So the fact that he got 2.5, you know, more than twice the time she got is sort of, I don't know if that's right. It doesn't feel right to me. And I'm not here to defend Sam Bankman-Fried at any level, but 25 years is a really long time. You kind of think that he'll get out early.
You get time off for good behavior.
You get time off for good behavior. There's appeals. Like, maybe he's not going to be in there for 25 years. But to take away, like, that's taking away someone's basically their whole young life. Like, he would get out and be over 50. Like, I don't know. That's a pretty serious thing to do when someone didn't do any violent crime or anything, you know, damaging to public health.
I mean, to be honest, though, it's a crazy sentence even for people who do violent crime. Like, the thing we know about violent criminals upon being released from jail is that if you get released from jail in your like mid-30s or 40s, or, you know, like, you tend not to be violent anymore, and you tend not to be convicted of further violent crimes. Like, violent crime is a crime of the young, overwhelmingly. Look, we've had this conversation on Slate Money many times. White collar sentences can feel extraordinarily punitive and too much, but by the same token, virtually all sentences in the American criminal justice system are punitive and too much.
Yeah.
And, you know, so like we have to use that context. Like, if you're a judge and you're handing down very punitive sentences day in and day out, because that's what American judges do, then this one is entirely in line, I think, with what you might see in other crimes. And the crime was truly enormous.
It was truly enormous. And there are people now, and Felix and I were fighting about this yesterday, but there are people now who are saying things like Sam Bankman-Fried is actually an investment genius. And, you know, he didn't really lose anyone's money. But really, like, the reason the estate is going to be able to recover so much money is, you know, John Ray, the guy in charge of doing that, is good at his job. And also because there's been this big rally in crypto. Like, apparently there was $1 billion worth of Solana at the bankruptcy filing time, but they didn't cash it out right away. So now it's worth like $10 billion. And that has nothing to do with Sam Bankman-Fried. I guess you could say it was his vision, but I don't know.
Right. Or like, you know, he made a $500 million investment in Anthropic, which is now worth, you know, an absolute fortune. It's just like, great. Okay. So like he gets lucky on some of the investments, but again, getting lucky on an investment does not mean you didn't commit the crime.
Yeah. John Ray has also made it very clear and has been very vocal about the fact that the company was run horribly and that, you know, some of his decisions were just inexplicable. So anyone calling SBF a genius at this point, I think, is just not paying attention.
They're not a genius either.
Let's move on to a perennial favorite subject on this here show, which is credit cards. We had a big class action settlement this week, which may not make a huge amount of difference in the short term, but could be pretty enormous in the longer term, which is basically that Visa and MasterCard have made an agreement with a bunch of merchants, and this has not been ratified, and a bunch of merchants say it doesn't go far enough, and you know, we don't know whether it's completely enforced, but the broad idea is that for the first time merchants are going to be able to say, if you come in here with a really expensive credit card with high interchange fees that's going to cost us like 3% every time we accept your payment, we can charge you more for using that credit card than if you come in with a credit card with a really low interchange fee. And so in theory, for the first time, which flavor of Visa card you have will affect the price you pay. And that is fascinating, because that kind of, that might finally give people an incentive to stop just using the highest reward card they can find, you know, because the highest reward card is also going to be the one that might wind up costing more to use in the shop.
Do you think, though, that people with very high-end credit cards are even going to notice that difference? Because what you're talking about is, you know, $2.60 in fees on every $100 versus $2.10. And if you're the person who pays up for, you know, a very high-end credit card, are you even going to register that, especially if you're spending a lot on things like hospitality and whatnot?
So two different questions there. The thing that the merchants are being allowed to do is charge more for the people using the more expensive cards. They, as far as I know, there's nothing in this agreement saying that you can only charge the difference in fees. So if they want to give everyone who doesn't use a Sapphire Reserve a $20 discount, but then just not give that discount to the people paying with the Sapphire Reserve, then they can do that. I don't think that the amount charged, the amount extra you need to pay for using that credit card, needs to be entirely commensurate with the cost to the merchant.
So what you just said, so at first the news of this broke my brain, because I was like, what merchant is going to be like, Sapphire users have to pay 5% more on transactions? Like, no merchant is going to do that. But what they'll do is say, like, if you have this card or that card or that card, you get 5% off, just like they do now with cash. If you pay cash in a lot of places, you get a little discount, 2%, 3%, whatever. And some people take advantage of that, but most, so that was like my first step in my brain unbreaking, like, okay, they're not going to advertise surcharges or extra fees. They're going to advertise discounts for other cardholders. And then I started thinking about those cash discounts. And the truth is, like, the cash discounts are cool, but most people don't use them, I think. Most people just still, they don't, maybe don't even have cash anymore, like we spoke about a few weeks ago. They're using digital totally. So, you know, they don't do it. So I kind of feel like it's going to wash out, maybe, because, you know, there's this worry like, oh my God, if I'm a Sapphire Blue person and then everyone who just has Visa regular is getting the discount, I'm not getting the discount. I'm not going to use my Sapphire Blue. And like maybe at the margins, some people will, if they have a different card, they'll switch to the different card. But if they don't, they'll probably still use their Sapphire Blue or their whatever, because at the end of the day, it's not like that big of a deal. Just like the cash discount isn't that big of a deal to people. They just want the convenience of their card.
Right. But the idea being that if you switch to the cheaper cards, that not only gets you access to those discounts, but it also saves you money in terms of like an annual fee, right? Because the more expensive cards generally carry an annual fee. And so what you're doing at that, what you're doing in this like possible future world, I'm not saying this future world is definitely going to happen, but it could happen. What you're doing is you're paying, you know, hundreds of dollars a year for the privilege of using the one card that doesn't give you a discount. And at that point, you start thinking to yourself, well, hang on a sec. If I just used a free card, I would get all of these discounts and I would save money on credit card fees. Like, at that point, do I really care about my lounge access?
I think it'll depend on how many merchants start doing the discounts, you know, how many merchants start advertising. Like, if you have this card or that card, we'll give you, you know, a break. Because if it's only in a few places, then I don't think people would change their card behavior.
The other thing that is allowed in this settlement is for merchants to group together and negotiate collectively to try and reduce the interchange that they pay. And so that's going to put like a downward pressure on interchange. And I do think that the big picture in America is that credit card interchange fees have been rising steadily and unconscionably. I think there was $170 billion last year or something crazy like that. It's a stupid system of kickbacks. Most of that $170 billion winds up getting like kicked back to rich Americans who pay for expensive cards in the form of like free flights and stuff. And it's just like, this is so dumb. You know, this does not really help anyone. And I guess, you know, except for Delta Airlines, you know, which is basically a credit card company with an airline attached.
People who carry balances on credit cards are basically funding rich people's cash back and rewards, you know, in addition to the things you just said. Kind of. They have to use the credit cards, pay the inflated prices for goods and services because of the fees.
Yes, that is true.
And then every month, you know, they don't pay their bill in full, don't get those fees back to them the way people who pay in full every month get cash back.
No, it's true. And the big hidden fee is just this thing that every single shop in America effectively, you know, charges 3% more than it really needs to, just because it needs to, build in the cost of the interchange. So yeah, so that's the question. Like, do we believe if interchange went away tomorrow, do we think that all prices in America would drop by 3%?
Deflation.
But like, I do think it is something that has pressured prices upwards over time. And if it went away, then there would be less upward pressure on prices and some downward pressure on prices. Like, merchants would find it a little bit easier to compete on price.
That's good. We could use a little downward pressure on prices, because we still do have some inflation that needs to calm down a bit.
There you go. The Fed should like this settlement.
This is an inflation-friendly development.
Numbers round. Let me start, because I have one this week. 1,300. That is the number of Ferraris that were sold in Taiwan last year. That accounts for 11% of the total global sales of Ferraris took place in Taiwan.
Is that normal? Do they normally buy more than 10% of the Ferraris in Taiwan?
No, they don't. This is a new development, and it's all to do with, you know, all of the TSMC gazillionaires.
Wow, that's great. Good for Taiwan. No?
You know, if you want to hang out with a bunch of Ferraris, just book a flight to Taipei. You can use your airline miles.
Who buys most of the Ferraris?
Not me. I can't afford Ferraris.
Is it Americans?
I know one Italian guy who has a collection of Ferraris and likes racing them on the tracks. How about you, Emily? What's your number?
My number is 100 million. 100 million newtons. Okay.
Ooh, I like this already. Is this a spaceship number?
No. That's what's so shocking. That's an estimate of the measure of force of impact when the container ship Dolly hit the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore earlier this week. It wasn't going very fast, but the ship is massive, like one third to one half the size of the Empire State Building. So even though it was going slow, like under 10 miles an hour, I don't know how to translate that into knots.
It's about 10 knots. It's a knot and a mile an hour, basically the same thing.
The same, knots, newtons, yeah. I know. So even though it was going really slow, it's so big and heavy, it collapsed the bridge. The New York Times upshot, I guess you call it a blog still, but they did this analysis and they figured it was 100 million newtons at least around of force when it hit the bridge, which is why it collapsed. And just to give you like a sense of comparison, if a fully loaded 18-wheeler collided with a bridge at 80 miles an hour, that would only be 1 million newtons. So
it's like 100 of those. 100 yes. Fully loaded 18-wheelers all going at 80 miles an hour and bashing into a bridge at the
yes.
same time.
Yes, or the Saturn V rocket thrust at launch was 35 million newtons. So, I mean, this is just like you begin to understand how a bridge could collapse when this giant container ship hit it, if you didn't already understand just intuitively when you saw the video.
Elizabeth, what's your number?
My number is 5, and that's pounds. And that's the weight of the bag of Kit Kats that my mother sent my 8-year-old for Easter. And it's enormous. And this is a little bit of a lead-in to our Plus segment, because I think now a portion of the global cocoa supply is in my house. And I'm just glad that she didn't try to send him 5 pounds of Peeps, or I would have gotten a box the size of a coffee table.
Wait, just plain Kit Kats, or are they Easter-themed?
They're Easter-themed Kit Kats.
What is the difference between an Easter-themed Kit Kat and a normal Kit Kat?
Pastel wrappers. Although apparently the Kit Kat is making a sort of lemon bar Kit Kat, which I assume is probably like white chocolate and lemon or something like that.
How does your son feel about having all these Kit Kats?
Weirdly, my son is good at, he will hoard things like that. So we will probably still have Kit Kats by the time he's able to drive.
Take them with him to college.
So my question is, and it's a very important question, and I feel like we need, you know, the Slate Money audience to write in on this question of extremely great import. Is there anything better than sliding your thumbnail down the foil wrapping of a Kit Kat and then snapping it off?
It is very satisfying.
I feel like the 90% of the success of Kit Kat is all just that weird sort of ASMR feeling of like slicing it open and breaking it off, rather than anything to do with the actual candy itself.
Our producer should put in a sound effect of a Kit Kat snapping so everyone can enjoy it.
First of all, lie down. Then ease out and think of irresistible crisp light wafers covered in delicious milk chocolate. Now, snap out of it.
On which delicious note, we will wrap up this podcast. You see what I did there? We will convey our deepest thanks to Jared Downing and Shayna Roth for producing. We will encourage you to write in on slatemoney@slate.com with talks of your favorite unwrapping sounds and feels. And we will tell you that on Tuesday, we are going to be back with a Money Talks episode. Emily, who are you talking to?
Felix, I'm talking to Cal Newport. He is a New Yorker contributor and so many other things, and the author of a new book called Slow Productivity. And our conversation was really good. If you care about workplace stuff like I do, you're going to want to listen.
So that's all coming up on Tuesday, but with any luck, you are a Slate Plus subscriber, so you're just about to hear us talk about cocoa. $10,000 a ton.
How many Kit Kats is that?